acá. Hombres, niños y mujeres, el esfuerzo siempre haremos. Campesinos, los obreros.
You're listening to Radio Zapatista. Chiapas no se olvida. We're bringing the revolution to your ears, as usual. And we're back in our studio, the KPFA studio in Berkeley tonight. I'm Daniel, and I've got Patty, Jesse, and Huichol with us here, and Pedro on the ones and twos. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the topic of indigenous land struggles and autonomy, and we're going to be talking about it from both sides of the border. So we're going to be talking about Mexico, about the situation in Chiapas that we've been talking about on previous programs, as well as some situations that are going on in the U.S. having to do with indigenous peoples here. And we're going to be doing some interviews with our special correspondent, Alejandro, who's in Chiapas right now, as well as with Professor Marlon Sherman, who's a professor at Humboldt State University. And he is a Lakota indigenous person from the U.S., and so we're going to be talking to him about what's going on there. So without further ado, let's get on with the program. We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back with the interview with Alejandro.
Are you ready to begin?
One more time, talking about the repression that's happening in Chiapas. We've heard for a couple of months now that there's been a repression happening in the town of Bolonaja. And we are going to hear today from Alejandro, who recently took a delegation of 36 compañeros and compañeras down to Bolonaja after the encuentro with mujeres in December. So, Alejandro, are you there?
Yes, I am, Patty.
Hola, compañero. How are you? Good to hear you.
Great being with you guys again.
So tell us, what happened? What was the delegation about, and how do you see things down there?
Okay, we actually, you know, there's four hotspots right now in Chiapas in terms of the threats of paramilitary threats and the threats of taking the lands away from the Zapatistas, and that's Bolomahao, sorry, which is next to the waterfalls of Agua Azul, the community of 24 de Diciembre, which is in the Caracol de la Realidad. There's Huitepec, which is a region close to San Cristóbal de las Casas. It's a natural reserve. And there's San Patricio. And we went to visit both Bolomahao and 24 de Diciembre. We're going to be visiting the other two communities in the next few days. Try to get an idea of what's going on in general in terms of this movement to take away the land from the Zapatistas. And so in Bolomahao, we went, it was a number of us, actually the delegation of 36 people, delegation, came before us. They were leaving as we were arriving. And the day that they left, which is the day that we arrived, that the previous night, there had been the people from the OPDIC, which is a paramilitary organization, had gone in. They had fired some shots in the air. And
Alejandro, what day did you go there, just to clear that up?
This was on January 2nd.
Okay.
So it was a few days ago. And they left, they hung a shirt in the cornfields, and they cut it up with machetes and so on. You know, but this is an ongoing threat that has been escalating in this region, and this is probably one of the most tense areas because of several things. The Optique is a paramilitary organization. They're organized. They have been increasingly violent. There was a person that was shot in December, late December, and also somebody that was attacked with machetes. And there, were, camp members from the civil society that have been going there, especially after the encounters, before and after the encounter, the women's encounter. One of these delegations was not physically attacked, but threatened by the people from Optique. They were drunk. They stopped them as they were trying to walk in. You know, you have to walk about 30 minutes to 45 minutes to get into the community from Agua Azul. They were detained there. And they were threatening the women of being raped and so on, a very violent confrontation. So this is, you know, but in order to understand this, we need to understand this is, there's some very high economic interests here. Agua Azul is a very important tourist destination in Chiapas, and the COMPAS have 339 hectares of land right next to waterfalls, which are very beautiful. It's a wonderful place. It's a very, very poor community that is defending the right of natural resources from economic interest, from, you know, tourism. And so the situation is very difficult. And I think one of the things that we fear is that this might get out of hand. Obviously, the government is manipulating these paramilitary groups in order to pressure the Zapatistas, grab the land away from them, and also try to disarticulate the movement. But these people have a will of their own. And I think the fear here is that they will get out of hand, and this might, you know, be living the chronicle of a massacre foretold. And the government isn't paying much attention to this.
What kinds of strategies are the communities there, the Zapatista communities? I mean, if we're talking about a confrontation with an armed paramilitary group that really doesn't have, they don't have any compunctions about using violence, what kinds of strategies can the Zapatista communities use against that strategy, you know, when the paramilitaries are working with the government together?
You know, this whole issue of resistance is very important because beyond looking at what kind of aggressions that these communities are suffering, we need to look at the forms of resistance in terms of peaceful resistance. You know, in none of these cases are the Zapatistas considering or resorting to physical confrontation or violent confrontation of any sort. So in the case of Olonahau, there is guarding the vigilance of the area, resisting peacefully while building autonomy, and there is a presence of civil society camp that has been very instrumental in sort of trying to keep something serious from happening. What we were worried about is that there has been a very large presence of people from La Otra Campaña that have been here from related to the encounter, but as the people start returning to their places of origin, the presence of civil society there will decrease. Mm. Obviously, the attention will be drawn away from it, and so we fear that that might leave the community much more vulnerable, you know, to an attack.
Alejandro,
yeah.
I know the COMPAS put out a call to boycott Agua Azul. Are there any people responding? Has it had any effect on the income that it's procreated in Agua Azul at all?
Yeah, I think it is. In fact, that might be one of the reasons why there was this show a few weeks ago of the Optique presumably turning in their weapons. You know, there was this event that was highly publicized of the Optique members turning in weapons that are actually very low caliber poor weapons. The compañeros tell us that they have actually 57 high-power weapons that are in their power with which they are threatening them. But there was a show of turning in the weapons to sort of, you know, probably in response to the economic pressure of the boycott. On the other hand, what this is publicly showing is that it is indeed an armed group, and they're sort of demonstrating it publicly. On the other hand, you know, this whole idea of the boycott has had a really probably more tangible effect right now in the other community that we visited, which was 24 de Diciembre. And as some of our listeners might remember, we did a documentary, we did a report on that in August when we went to visit that community. You know, this community was founded in 2006, in December of 2006. 7 months after that it was founded, it started being attacked, burning cornfields and with death threats and blocking roads and, you know, a very, very tense situation. So our report in August was one that showed, you know, a community that was very in imminent danger. Right now, that tension seems to have decreased, and I think that has a lot to do with the boycott that is going on right now against Café de la Selva. The people that are threatening this community are the members of Unión Ejidos de la Selva, and there was an international call to boycott Café de la Selva, which it sells in both, but, you know, in Mexico, but also internationally. There's at least one place in the U.S. where it sells. Presumably, you know, organic coffee with what is supposed to be, or is publicized as a model of, you know, sustainable development and so on, where in fact this is a group that is an armed and violent group that has been harassing Zapatistas. What the compas tell us also is that Café de la Selva is not organic, in fact. You know, that they have proof that they use pesticides and so on, but they sell it as organic and self-sustainable and so on. So the boycott here seems to be at least working, which doesn't mean that 24 December, the December is not under threat right now. You know, they're still suffering from everyday threats. In November, they burned the sugarcane field, and they tried to cut down a cornfield that the compas had planted. But, you know, in terms of resistance, 24 de Diciembre is really fascinating, because what they have done, in addition to the boycott, is they have a large number of compañeros from, you know, compas and zapatistas from different communities that go there and guard the entire region. In order to keep the people from 24 de Diciembre to lose their cool and to, you know, get into a violent confrontation. So this is, and this has been very effective. At some point when we were there in August, there was 100 compas guarding the place. Right now there's only 30 of them. This number varies. In November, 140 came down to protect the cornfields that were being threatened, and they managed to protect the cornfields. So, you know, they use several strategies in terms of both peaceful protection from their own, you know, from Zapatistas' bases of support themselves, as well as the support of civil society in terms of boycott, in terms of civil society camp members that are there to document and guard the place from an attack.
Bueno, Alejandro, pues we thank you for this report back, and we'll definitely keep in contact with you. So,
okay, compañeros, well, thanks a lot, and it's been nice being with you guys again.
All right.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
we're back in the studio here, and we want to note that our website, which is radiozapatista.org, has more information about the Chiapas, the war of the low intensity war that's going on in Chiapas right now, and the show that we did last week also has information, and there's a long discussion about the repression in Bolonajau and all these other communities. And so I think there's a lot more information there if you want to check that out, and as well on Indie Media. But now we're going to be talking with switching sort of the border, crossing the border, talking about indigenous land struggles and autonomy in the U.S. And Jesse, I don't know if you want to introduce.
And with us today to talk about these issues is Professor Marlon Sherman from Humboldt State University. He's a professor of Native American Studies, also part of the Lakota tribe, and he's going to dialogue with us for a while. The Lakota recently made a group of Lakota peoples made a declaration for a pretty much autonomy, as we talked about last week. We want to talk about some of the maybe contradictions and tensions around that declaration. Marlon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Marlon. It's good to hear your voice again.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Well, last week we were talking a little bit about the sort of the idea of autonomy and the power of this call, this declaration of continued independence or renewed independence, you know, coming out of this Lakota tribe. And so, you know, we're interested in questions of autonomy in Mexico, particularly coming out of the Zapatista movement. So this obviously caught our attention, and we were wondering, you know, if you could tell us a little about what you think, how you see this as, what sort of benefits or positive, what kind of benefits do you see to this sort of Declaration of Independence?
At this point, it's a little bit early to see the benefits, although it is a call to action, which is a good thing. People have become very complacent. You know, the tribal governments tend to get caught up in the bureaucracy, and there's so many different battles to fight, especially for the Lakota. Speaking for the Lakota, battles over water, over land use, over toxics on the land, uranium mining, and then, of course, just the fact of racism in the state of South Dakota. So there are so many things that are pushing in on the Lakota nation as a whole, that any call for unity is bound to have some positive consequences, even though in the beginning it looks as if there is quite a bit of dissent among different groups of people. Notably, the folks who made the call for freedom, the Republic of Lakota, or as they also call themselves, the Lakota Oyate. And I've been keeping track of some of the comments and some of the differing opinions. And people, I believe, are a little bit afraid of this strong call for freedom.
Why?
Well, because it's something, people have, various Lakotas have tried over the years, or various natives have tried over the years, to assert independence and have been crushed by the United States government, by the military, by the police forces. So it can cause a little bit of fear just thinking about the consequences down the road. There have already been a few threats, sort of not very subtle threats that if Lakota keep this up, that something bad will happen. So there's bound to be some fear, but I think fear is a good thing. It shows people are thinking about the consequences. They also need to be thinking about the possibilities.
And one of the creators of this this document that was created by Russell Means, and I've seen a lot of the media that it has been bad-mouthing him or seeing other perspectives that maybe he's in it because of the capital wealth that they can procreate through using the Lakota lands for some capitalistic way of means. What do you see in terms of that?
Well, that is controversy tends to surround Russell Means wherever he goes. He is a controversial figure.
He was a controversial figure back in the 70s when the American Indian movement was very strong and military, and has continued. And he's put himself in a position where, you know, he's played in Hollywood under, in some films that could conceivably be seen as assimilationist. And so, yeah, he does tend to bring an element of controversy and it leads often to dissent when he gets involved in a situation. He's also been associated with libertarians. You know, it's problematic, but there are good, strong, passionate people who are associated with this as well.
Definitely.
So it's a shame that people would focus on Russell Means as a central figure and to ignore the issues, which are, of course, autonomy and treaty violations.
I think that's actually a really good point, because it brings attention renewed attention to the fact that, you know, all these treaties have been broken and violated consistently by the U.S. government, and that, you know, it makes sense to question the legitimacy of those treaties, even outside. It's interesting, in reading some of the articles that have been talking about this stuff, you see a lot of talk about how it's completely legal and legitimate for the Lakota tribe to withdraw from the United States legally under U.S. law. But what I think is interesting is also to reflect that, it's almost as if U.S. law has been abrogated by the U.S. government, which has violated so many treaties in the past.
Oh, absolutely. It's without question. The United States government has been extremely heavy-handed and hypocritical in taking a Christian civilized position toward other people, or toward the actions, the workings of its government. But then its actions in the field say something entirely different. So yes, whether the treaties mean anything is problematic, although the Lakota position for years has been that it doesn't matter what the United States does or says. You know, the Lakota position is that we've made our agreements, we stand by our agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So this abrogation of the treaties, or rather this call for nullification of the treaties, can be a two-edged thing as well. You know, it's possible that people could see it as moving away from a principled stand.
Mm-hmm.
What are your expectations on this call? Do you think that people are going to rise up to this declaration, or are people just going to do what has happened prior and just go back to being conformative?
Well, there will always be some of either. There will always be committed activists. There will always be militants. There will be the middle of the roaders, and then there will be some negotiators. And it's up to the Lakota leaders, to true Lakota leaders, to find a way to negotiate this ground, and to bring the people together. And I'm not sure who the people are to do that. Whether it is the elected leaders of the various Lakota tribes or the traditional leaders who are basically appointed by their communities.
Yeah.
Should be maybe some of both.
Marlon, and you've been perhaps part of a couple conversations around autonomy, and if you could share with us historically what those conversations have been and how perhaps this idea of autonomy has been changing for the Native American community, or specifically your community?
By my community, you mean the Lakota community or the Native community in Northern California? I have to clarify that, because there are different, you know, there are 500-odd Native nations within the United States, and each has its own prerogative. So if we're talking about autonomy, there are a number of different groups among the Lakota Oyate, among the Lakota Nation, who already act autonomously, who do not recognize the tribal governments as having any power or authority over them, because they see them as as puppets of the United States. Mm-hmm. There are people who go their lives without ever having to, or trying not to deal with those governments. For instance, up here on the North Coast, we're working with a group of Yurok people, mm-hmm, in reestablishing a traditional Yurok community on the shores of the Klamath River, a very sacred place, and trying to do that without any assistance from the tribal government. So there are different ways of doing it, and it's not, they're not at odds with the tribal governments at all. It's just that these are people who are existing and doing the things that their particular indigenous cultures see as necessary, the ceremonies, the ways of life, you know, gathering the salmon, raising the buffalo, or rather allowing the buffalo to raise themselves.
Professor Sherman, we're sort of running out of time, but I wanted to ask you one last question, which actually is sort of a complicated question, and you can go in any direction that you want with it. But I just sort of wanted to ask you what you thought that autonomy actually means for the Lakota people. I mean, we talk a lot about Zapatista autonomy, but autonomy doesn't necessarily mean the same thing for, you know, everybody around the world. So I was wondering what you thought that might mean for them.
I think that autonomy for a lot of Lakota points right back to 1868, to the last major treaty that the Lakota Nation signed as a powerful military and economic presence. And so I would say that a return to that sort of way of dealing with the United States government, but more importantly, a way of dealing among ourselves without any assistance or interference from any other governments. You know, that's the very nature of autonomy is doing what is best for your own people in your own particular geographic and spiritual location. You know, running your own economy without any outside influence. So autonomy involves a lot of things, but I think necessarily it involves separating yourself from the federal and state governments so that you can do those things without their interference. And if it involves closing your borders to your particular territory, well, so be it. Hopefully there would be friendly relations, because no border can exist. No group of people can exist very long,
exactly,
if it has poor relations with its neighbors across the border.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your presence tonight and this really interesting interview. It was really, really good.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be on the air with you. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you and good night.
Good night. Creíamos que era mejor morir ante los invasores hasta que probamos con la tierra. Los hombres blancos nos ayudaron en eso. Eso nos salvó a todos porque descubrimos que podíamos vivir con los blancos, solo viviendo como ellos.
Okay, we have announcements, and one of them is the Elders and Vision and La Misión have been occurring. Here an invitation being made by Seth Peters Housing Committee, using all listeners to go an open house for their units that were once occupied by elder folks and discourage potential buyers. The open hours are from 2 to 4 p.m. every Sunday at 1298 3rd Street, at the corner of 3 and 26 in La Misión. Supporters can bring signs or just themselves and family, friends. There are still 4 other things next to those where more elderly folks are fighting from being evicted, and they will really appreciate the support. Sally and Ellie, 10 of 35 years, passed recently on December the 11th due to the health problems that were extributed by stress from trying to keep this home. For more information, you can contact South Peters Housing Committee Office at 415-487-9203.
Let's stop the evictions.
Yeah. And one more announcement is we're having a hip-hop and La Peña. It's in Shattuck in Berkeley, so those people like hip-hop, so come and join to La Peña.
It's on tonight.
Yeah.
And don't forget to visit our website is radiozapatista.org. So we'll see you next month.